Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com. Coming up on today's edition of Trumpet Radio Live, some interesting headlines to take a look at, and also an important day in history, a note to bring out, as well as continuing to look at this really wonderful booklet, God is a Family. We'll look at some more of that. That and more coming up on this Tuesday edition of Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live. We're at 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com has a live link as well. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, please do that at kpcgfm. And if you'd like to send an email, you can send those to comments at kpcg.fm. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon here today. I had a confession that I gave to Grant here right before we went on the air. You know, it's getting close to Thanksgiving time, right? So people are starting to bring food around. Someone brought a sweet potato pie. Store-bought, but it was delicious. It is delicious. And put it down in the break room, and I've eaten about 25% of it by myself. But I didn't do it in one pass. I made a pass by it and had a piece, and then noticed a while later, like, well, no one else is jumping on this. So so that's my confession. I just admitted it to everyone.
Well, a sweet potato pie is kind of a less common flavor, so probably people were a little bit more hesitant, and you're just taking advantage of that. Not too picky. Enjoy that type of pie, so there you go.
It's delicious, and the package said it has to be used by the 24th of November, so that's probably why it's sitting there. I checked the date, and I'm like, I got 3 days. I'm going
to eat that. It's not even past the date at all yet.
Usually that's just a guesstimate. Usually you can go a little longer than that, although I have had it happen one time where I had some creamer for my coffee in my little fridge here that I have in my office, and I pulled it out one day, and it was on the expiration date, and I thought, oh, it's fine. And no, it wasn't. It's like that one was exactly on. Do not use it on the day after the expiration date, I guess it was. So usually you get a little window there, but that one was very specific.
Yeah, that's tough sometimes to figure it out. I guess the safest thing to do is have it all finished a couple months before the expiration date. Then there's no room for error. There are some stores that sell things for cheaper because they're closer to the expiration date than most other stores have it. I actually like that. It's a nice discount.
Yeah, it can be a little bit of a gamble, I guess. There are some products that don't have expiration dates. You should probably avoid those. Do Cheetos have expiration dates?
No, I don't think so. I think Twinkies could survive the nuclear holocaust. There are some products like that that it just proves to you that there's not really much good in them.
Well, occasionally you see people selling, you'd call them food items, I guess, on eBay, and they're older and they're not making them anymore, so now it's a novelty item. And I don't think people buy it to consume, but you could, I guess. One being the infamous Crystal Pepsi. You probably don't remember that, but no. That was Pepsi that was clear. It didn't really taste like anything. It was a really, really strange thing, and it didn't last. People didn't like it, but it was kind of the new thing they were trying to do in the early 90s, and now I did see somebody trying to sell those on eBay. Somebody had a case of it. It was quite expensive. And I thought, well, surely nobody would drink it. It must just be a novelty.
Yeah, I've never heard of that before. I wonder if it might strike my fancy somehow.
I don't know. It's a really... I've had this conversation with people from my generation. I'm like, you remember that drink? And they're like, yeah, kind of. And I said, it didn't taste like anything to me, and they had the same thought. Like it didn't taste bad, but it didn't taste good. Like, I don't know what it was. And so I think that's why it didn't last.
Yeah, my favorite's actually like any type of soda with the cherry flavor in it. Cherry Coke, cherry Pepsi, cherry Dr. Pepper, whatever it is. Those are always the best ones to me. I don't know how much I would like Crystal Pepsi because it just sounds like sparkling water.
Yeah, it wasn't even that. Like it was not a good deal. But anyway, sometimes those items pop up on eBay and people try to sell them. And I guess somebody's buying them. That's why they're up there. There's a new statistic out here showing how old people are in the United States and what group you might fall into. It's kind of interesting. If you are between the ages of zero, which I don't know what that is. Well, let's say you were born at 19. That's 25% of the U.S. population. 20 to 39, 27%, that's the biggest group. 40 to 59, that's 26%. 60 to 79, 18%. If you're over 80 years old, it's only 4% of the U.S. population. And that number is dropping, by the way.
Yeah, that might be a bad sign that we're not as healthy as we once were, because it seemed like not too long ago, not too long ago, but recently we could live a little bit longer than that and be able to keep up our health, but it's a pretty unhealthy society today.
Well, there's a whole big write-up in the recent Time magazine about just the elder care and how it's really a huge issue also in terms of just the U.S. economy. There's a lot of people that are getting into that older category where they're starting to need some more assistance, and the cost of some of that. And when you look at prescription drugs or you look at all these different things that are out there, now, I don't know if people absolutely need it. They're taking it one way or the other, but the cost is so expensive, and that's why there's such a problem with the healthcare system, because of the really high cost of things and all the care and so forth, and then this pretty large segment of the population that needs this, apparently, for a period of time, at least they think they do, and where does the money come from to pay for it?
That is a really difficult situation for a lot of people, because like the elder care homes, I mean, they cost like $5,000 or $10,000 a month in a lot of cases. Sometimes even just to share a room, it's around that much money. And yet, aren't you supposed to try to save up money for your future generations of your family? Well, if you're spending that much money every single month that you're in a home like that, it pretty much saps your inheritance that you hope to pass on to your family.
Yeah, that's really disappointing when you see things like that happen. It's if somebody's worked hard their whole life, they should have something to pass on as opposed to having it taken all at the end. But anyway, that's an ongoing crisis here in the U.S. and I suppose globally, but it seems like here in the U.S. especially. Here's an interesting headline from today. This is from PJ Media. ISIS group releases image of beheaded Pope Francis. That's pretty inflammatory, to say the least. Just a few days after circulating a propaganda poster depicting a jihadist driving toward the Vatican, a pro-ISIS media group today released another poster depicting Pope Francis beheaded. So they're putting out their propaganda there. And, most people wouldn't be that bold, I guess, to go after the Pope in that way. There's a lot of power there with the Pope and the Vatican. But they are definitely, at least in some factions of Islam, looking to spark a little bit of conflict there.
Talk about a double standard, too. What happens every time you draw any sort of an insulting depiction of Muhammad? They kill everybody. So it's just kind of confusing why they would think they could do that to someone else's religious leader.
Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't thought of that, but it's true. That's and if somebody was to go after, an Islamic figure or something like that, they get quite a bit of scorn, even in a lot of the media. But they're doing the same thing. So just this conflict back and forth. And, of course, also just with Europe, I mean, they're struggling right now. Germany's got this problem with not being able to form a coalition government, and yet they have this migrant crisis and a lot of pressure there, and a lot of it is coming, the external pressure anyway, a lot of it's coming from Islam or those Islamic nations. As people pour out, try to get into Europe and cause all these different difficulties, then they have these internal election problems and there's this religious conflict. So not peace. We don't see the seeds of peace between these two religions.
Yeah, and it is important to trace these problems back to the root, looking back at the region where these migrants are coming from or where the extremism is coming from. And whatever you're talking about, it always gets back to Iran, doesn't it? Iran's either helping Syria as Syria abuses and drives out its own people, which then causes the migrant crisis in Europe, or they're funding terrorism all around the world and using even ISIS as just a distraction away from what they're doing. All the while, they continue to develop their nuclear weapons and pretty much get away with it.
And they're getting more cash. As the Trumpet.com pointed out yesterday, Britain's going to give them, what is this, over 500 million U.S. dollars. Or was it billion? It was a lot. Anyway, go back
to
that.
Might have been billion. I don't know.
Check that story out at the Trumpet.com. Quite a bit of money that they're offering there. Probably million. I think that's what it was. A lot of cash. We'll put it that way. One way or the other, trying to get back some hostages. So anyway, you can check that out at thetrumpet.com and get those numbers all pinned down. But definitely they're going to put that money to bad use, no doubt, in Iran. Here's a story from Bloomberg that's kind of interesting in relation to the hurricanes that happened a while ago. Easy to kind of forget about those, but still a big deal. Mobile homes are so expensive now, hurricane victims can't afford them. Quite a few people lost their homes, and then they lived in mobile homes, like in retirement communities and other places. And they bought the mobile home years ago for a certain price, and they can't afford to replace them because they've gotten so expensive now. Some of these mobile homes are $200,000.
That is just outrageous, especially considering that the reason they're looking for a new mobile home is because the one that they were in was easily wiped out in a lot of cases. Even on the fringes of the hurricane, sometimes they were just easily wiped out, unlike how other homes would have been affected. So how is it really so valuable that you can price gouge like that?
The market's increasing. I was surprised by this. It says about 22 million Americans live in manufactured homes, a classification that dates back to 1976, when federal law set standards for what used to be called mobile homes. Sales of new units are growing 15% annually as the base of buyers expands from rural areas to suburbs and retirement enclaves. Tile backsplashes and kitchen pantries fatten profits and attract buyers who couldn't afford similar extravagances in conventional houses. So they're decking these guys out. The industry, which it's like, I don't know, not to put down these homes, they're probably nice, but it just reminds me of like the car that's not that nice, but it's got the expensive rims and the big stereo in it. You're like, yeah, you had to put all your money into the stereo and the rims, but the car wasn't that great.
Yeah, I guess that's a decision we all have to make, what we're going to pour our money into. Sometimes it probably would be wise to make the house the nicest thing, because that's the most, I guess that's the most stable part of someone's life usually. But some of us want our entertainment systems or our flashy cars or whatever else.
Yeah, they say the industry, which makes 80% of new homes that sell for less than $150,000. Of course, the cost of conventional housing is going up as well. So this is going up too. Was struggling to keep up with demand even before the hurricanes. Manufacturers that closed plants after the housing crash say they're having difficulty adding capacity because of a shortage of skilled labor. Dealerships such as Lee Corp, among the biggest in Southwest Florida, have backlogs as long as 6 months. So if people in Florida or in the surrounding area that may want what do they call them now? Oh, manufactured home. There we go. You might have to wait at least 6 months for that. So they don't have enough skilled labor. They don't have the capacity to make them, and the market's growing.
Yeah, that's I guess that's surprising, but I mean, probably a big reason for the price surge for these mobile homes or manufactured homes is just the fact that regular homes prices have been skyrocketing, especially in certain regions like the Bay Area, mm-hmm. where, I mean, who in the world could even afford some of those prices that they have? What, like, you know, close to $10,000 a month for a home, several thousand just for an apartment? I mean, it's just the prices of everything are going up so much, and then people try to turn to mobile homes because they're less expensive. But sure enough, when the demand goes up, so does the price.
Buy a tent.
Buy a tent.
Some people are living in them, actually. It says Irma and Harvey damaged almost 1.8 million homes, causing uninsured flood losses of as much as $57 billion. A lot of people didn't have that flood insurance, and you know, it's easy to say, well, they should have, but they lived in an area where it doesn't flood. Mm-hmm. Until you get a hurricane, well, then it floods. So they say homeless shelters in the Naples, Florida area, the waiting list for beds has doubled, especially for single mothers and their children, many of whom are living in tents in the woods or in cars. And this is when their properties are damaged in a place like this, it's next to impossible to bounce back. Many have had to walk away from damaged mobile homes they can't repair or replace. So again, if you've bought a home, I think there was an example of somebody that bought a home years back for $45,000. It was a mobile home. Got destroyed because of the hurricane, and to replace it, to get like the same basic model, now it's over, you know, it's over $100,000, and the person makes $20,000 a year. Oof. They're not in a position to buy a new one, so that's where a lot of people find themselves.
it's almost hard to think about problems like this too much, because it's just so sad to think of people's homes being destroyed. Like you said, the single mothers with children having difficulty and having to try to turn to a homeless shelter. It's just really hard to even think of physical solutions right now for problems like that, when you have large scale, widespread devastation. It's hard to keep up with that and help everyone out in a timely manner.
Yeah, and you were talking about how expensive it is to live in some areas, and it is. It's crazy. Here's the data for the most expensive places in North America, and this is a cost of city living, so just being there in general. But what they're looking at here is showing how many years it would take to buy a home in these areas if you spent 100% of your family's income. Nobody's going to do that. You're not going to spend 100% of your income. But if you did, here's how long it would take. How many years it would take you to pay off some places. I'll start with the least expensive to the most here. Detroit, it would take you 1.8 years. Montreal, 4.2 years. Chicago, 5.9 years. Again, that's 100% of your income going to housing. Mexico City, 6.1 years, which is strange. I guess they probably don't get paid a lot. San Diego, 8.3 years. Boston, 10 years. San Francisco, 13.8 years. Most expensive in North America is Vancouver. If you paid 100% of your family's income just on housing, it would take you 17.3 years to pay off your house.
Just
can you imagine that?
Well, and that's obviously, it's going to be more than your home loan. I mean, you have like either a 15-year or 30-year mortgage in almost every case. And it's going to take 17 years if you pay 100% of your income. How do people pay off the entire loan by the time that the 15 or 30 years expires?
Well, yeah, and that's where you start getting into the same problem we had last time, right, in 2007 and 8. People buying homes that they can't afford but thinking, well, the market's going up, so if I get in now and it jumps all this, I'll just sell it. I'll never, you know, and then I can take all my money and get out of here. And some people do that and do it successfully, and other people get burned and get held holding the bag, as they say. And, you know, I think from the books that I've read, I think it's pretty sound advice. They say you shouldn't spend more than about 25% of your income on your housing.
Yeah.
And so if you're living in some of these areas, I don't think that's possible unless you're coming into it with millions of dollars.
Yeah, so 25% of a 17-year payment would be 68 years. If you were just spending 25% of your income instead of all of it, it would take you 68 years to pay that off. I've never heard of such a long home loan.
No.
Maybe they exist, but I've never heard of one.
No, I've never heard of that. I think I've never heard of anything beyond 30.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'd like to take a 100-year home loan. Well, car loans now, you can 72 months is common. That's
yeah.
a long time to pay on a car loan. And of course, they can stretch those payments out, and then you look at your monthly payment. You say, well, I could afford that because it looks cheaper. But the reality is you're paying for a lot longer time, so they're jacking the price up there, the total price, but it makes it look better because of the monthly payment.
Yeah, and then you're just shackled to that monthly payment for a long time. I've learned that the fewer monthly payments you have, the better. Any ones that you can possibly get rid of, it seems worth it. It gives you peace of mind to not have to worry about so much of your money every single paycheck going toward these monthly payments.
Yeah, it gives us great freedom, for sure. Related to this, just looking at some of the hurricane aftermath, Washington Examiner says that according to the Florida governor, 2,000 people are leaving Puerto Rico every day, 84,000 in 42 days. Because they got to get out of there. Puerto Rico's main source of income is not tourism, they say. It's manufacturing, which surprised me. Mm. Pharmaceuticals, medical devices, electronics, and computers. That means when you have zero revenue because of no power on the island, the already weakened economy is going to get worse, according to a representative from Puerto Rico. And the people leaving a lot of times are the laborers that are looking for a different job, and so they're losing their tax base there. Mm-hmm. So Puerto Rico is just getting blasted after the storm because of the infrastructure is wiped out on the island.
And even before this hurricane hit them, they were on the verge of total bankruptcy as well. So you can only imagine how bad it must be now with that hurricane wiping them out, with the mass exodus of so many of their workers, the inability to produce anything anymore over there. Just how long it's taking to try to rebuild the infrastructure despite the government's best efforts. They're in a big, big amount of trouble, and it's going to be difficult for the government to find the money to help them.
Yeah. Tough situation in Puerto Rico. Here's a story that's interesting. We talked about Baltimore a little bit because of all the violence going on there. No surprise that there's a very big anti-police movement as well. Those two things go hand in hand. But this is from the Baltimore Patch, which is a funny. Makes me think of a pumpkin patch. Police lockdown to end ACLU questions constitutionality. There we go. So this officer was killed a few days ago in Baltimore, and the blocks surrounding the area in Baltimore have been blocked off because surrounding the murder scene because they were doing investigation, trying to figure out who killed the officer, and they were advertising a $215,000 reward for information on the death of Detective Sean Suter. And but so people started getting upset that the police were there trying to figure out what was going on. And so the ACLU came out, that's the American Civil Liberties Union for Maryland, of course, issued a statement. And they were troubled by what the police are doing in this situation. They say, "We are troubled by reports that some persons entering or leaving the area have been subject to pat-down searches and that non-residents have been barred from entering the area." So that's their big concern. As they try to figure out who murdered the police officer, they're concerned that when you enter and leave the area, if you live there, you're allowed to come and go. If you don't live there, you can't come and go. And if you do live there and come and go, they want to pat you down. They're upset by that. Well, that just seems to me like, why make an argument? It doesn't seem like it's a big deal. The big issue is that somebody's murdering police officers more so than being able to come and go without getting a pat down. I mean, if you have nothing to hide, go on your way. How long could it take? I understand you wouldn't love that every day, but considering a police officer got murdered in your neighborhood, I think it would probably come with the territory that they've got to check things out a little bit.
And shouldn't every single resident be fine with the police being there and hopefully catching the murderer so that he can't be hanging around there and hopefully, and you know, possibly even doing something like that in the future? I mean, it would only be common sense that you'd want the police around protecting the area where a murder had just happened anyway, and yet I guess the ACLU is advocating the police to just leave and maybe, you know, help some people get away with committing crimes. Maybe it's difficult to commit crimes when there are police right next to where you live all the time.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. If somebody's willing to murder a police officer, they'll murder anybody.
Yeah.
It's not like they're going to have some sort of moral code there at that point. And, yeah, you'd want that element out of your neighborhood, you would think. And so the attention should be on the fact that there's a problem in Baltimore, and one of the main reasons there's a problem is this anti-government, anti-police, anti-authority sentiment, lawlessness. But their main concern is they don't like the way the police are conducting the investigation into a murder of one of their own. Mm-hmm. And so they're just jumping right back and really just making the whole story about blaming the police. We're just doing their job and doing it in very difficult circumstances when they've had somebody killed, you know, that they know probably quite well, and obviously they're in the line of danger as well. But they're making the story about, well, the police aren't being fair, and that just seems so out of balance to me.
Well, now I'm curious as to how many of these residents maybe issued a complaint, made a complaint to the ACLU about it. Maybe they're on the side of the shooter, because if there is an anti-police sentiment and the shooter acted on that and a lot of other people feel that way, maybe they don't feel fear that this person could then turn on them as well. I don't really know, but it just seems like I don't know how the ACLU would pick up on it unless someone who was actually there were complaining about it.
It's an interesting question. I saw a really interesting interview the other day with somebody that lives in the Chicago area and knows some of the police there, I guess, pretty well. And they were talking about the high crime rates in Chicago. And the question was posed. They said, well, Chicago's always had a lot of crime, but why is it like getting worse and worse? And the person said that they thought it's because they actually took out the wrong criminals, because there was the criminal element there in the city, and they kind of kept the forces balanced. Like, we'll do this criminal activity, that other group can do their criminal activity, we know not to cross paths. And the police kind of knew and said, okay, fine. And then once a year would, like, you know, conduct a raid or something just to make it look good. But they knew they couldn't stop the crime. They didn't feel like without, you know, overwhelming force or something. So they just kind of struck this balance. But then some of the top criminals got killed or something happened. And so now it's a battle for territory and all of this. So that was that guy's thought anyway.
That could be true. That would make sense. I mean, obviously, if you have a huge leader of a certain district of the city taken out, there's all of a sudden there's a vacuum. And we've even seen that with some of the Mexican drug cartels. For example, when El Chapo was in prison, which has been several times, I think he's in prison right now again, but several of his top people were trying to take over his cartel, because even if you're on the same side, if the top leader is gone, all of a sudden everyone wants to know who the next person in charge is, and often it's the most aggressive person. So a lot of this violence could even just be people from the same gang turning on each other, trying to take control when the vacuum is opened up.
That's why the policing is such a hopeless job, because they're just trying to keep it sort of, you know, from completely erupting, but they never go in there and actually root out the crime problem. It is too much of it. So obviously there needs to be, you know, the solution isn't to just kind of, you know, all right, well, you commit your crime over there, we'll commit ours over here. You got to get rid of it all, but how would you do that as a police force? You know, how would you go in and root out all crime? And then half the time, there's corruption in some of the other more lawful supposed offices as well. So just shows a lawlessness in the cities and really in the U.S. in general.
And it just shows you as well that our police officers, our law enforcement needs to have the authority to instill some fear, because a lot of people just don't have respect for law like they should. And if police officers are allowed to use lethal force without facing the backlash of the entire nation every time it happens, well, then maybe a few more people will think, I should probably pause before confronting this officer or committing this crime, because people are not going to side with me anymore. They're going to side with the police officers. And I guess that gets back to just the entire climate in the country. That needs to change, but also just the police need to be able to have more free rein. They can't just be restricted every time there's a riot. They can't just be standing behind their riot gear and not allowed to put a stop to whatever is happening.
Well, too, and you just have to, just knowing what Bible prophecy talks about in Ezekiel with the problems that are going to erupt in cities in the U.S., it's all there already. It's just a matter of what sets it off. You've got the criminal element. You've got the lawlessness. You've got, of course, weapons, obviously, and everything else. What's it going to take for it to erupt to where you can't stop it anymore? I mean, that's kind of what the police have been trying to do over the years, to just kind of say, well, that's the bad part of town. Just keep it over there. All the elements are there. It's like starting a fire, you know? You got all the kindling there. You got the stuff you need to get the fire going. It's just a matter of lighting the match, and then what are you going
to
do?
Yeah, it's obviously quite naive to think that the bad part of the town is going to stay confined to that little part and never expand. I mean, that's like the rotten apple in the crate of apples. It's going to eventually cause the rest of the apples to rot. The crime is going to spread, especially when at the same time you're taking away the powers of law enforcement and not allowing them to forcefully keep them in that area. If they're allowed to spread and they're not fearful of breaking laws anymore, why wouldn't they try to take over more of the city and seize more power for themselves?
Well, and also, I think it shows just the way that, say officers and the police forces would maybe kind of contain things in cities for a time. It shows that they know where the issue is. I mean, it's not like there's a great mystery as to who's doing certain things, probably within the law enforcement circles, because they deal with it. And so, you know, whenever they're looking for somebody, they're looking for trouble, you know, looking for whoever's causing the trouble, I'm sure they have a pretty good idea who it is.
Yeah.
You know, and then it kind of gets back to the whole, well, you can't profile. Well, yeah, but if that guy's been, you know, involved in this, I think you should take a look at him. Or, you know, if he has the markings of a gang member or something like that, that's a pretty good clue. If you're going to be a good detective, you look for clues, right? But in the climate we're in, you're not allowed to look at the obvious clues. You're supposed to somehow figure out who did it without investigating in any way or profiling.
Isn't political correctness just so extremely destructive? When we prioritize potential criminals, we don't want them to be inconvenienced by being stopped and frisked. We don't care as much about who they might harm or kill after not being stopped and frisked. We care more about the convenience of everyone being stopped for a second or two, or you know, we want the police officers to back down. There are people being killed because the police officers aren't being allowed to do their job. And we have a really serious problem just with the way that people hate the officers in this country. I mean, it's getting really bad. I've seen some videos of just instances just in the streets of big cities where maybe there's a black police officer and you have a bunch of black citizens going up to him, spitting in his face, screaming at him that he's a traitor. How did we get to the point where a big section of the population feels like the police are against them and always looking to hunt them down and kill them? We've really got a huge problem on our hands that isn't going to be fixed easily. We know the media is pushing that message that law enforcement is just across the board a racist institution, and a lot of people are believing that. How is it that we can uphold any laws if so many people hate the people trying to uphold those laws?
Yeah, it's the ingredients for a really bad situation, for sure. Make sure you stop and check out thetrumpet.com today. The top story is Why the Trumpet Watches Russia Allying with China. We talked about this really great book a while ago, Russia and China in Prophecy, which you should look at. But this particular write-up is by Jeremiah Jacques, and it says, a newly developing axis of two Asian giants is changing the world order. We have been forecasting the development of this unlikely partnership for over half a century. And so there is more going on there with Russia and China getting closer together. And, of course, they have a common enemy in the West, in the United States. So make sure you read that article today there as well. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show today, make sure you listen for that. Coming up here in a bit, and also it's online at thetrumpet.com and kpcg.fm. And Stephen Fleury today talks about this ongoing moral situation, immorality, I guess, here in the U.S. Another one, well, can I say, bites the dust, I guess. Charlie Rose, he's 75, I think, and famous for his show where he would interview people. He had that famous black background. He'd sit there at the table with them and talk about things. Sort of highbrow, I guess, as it were. And then, of course, he was doing some work on CBS. He was a morning show host for, I think, about 5 years or so. And lo and behold, he's also in the mix on all of these sexual assault situations. So it's getting to the point where it almost feels like, why doesn't everybody just line up and just, do you have anything you'd like to say? Any confession you want to make just to get this over with? But more and more is coming out. It seems like every day now somebody that's pretty prominent is being accused, at least, if nothing else.
Yeah, and probably a lot of them are afraid to speak out, which has been what people are doing. Whenever there's another allegation, a lot of these celebrities or media personalities, obviously they want to speak out condemning whoever was accused. But if they've done it too, they don't want to be saying things, because then whoever was abused by that person who's now condemning someone else could be like, well, wait a second, what are you doing talking whenever you've also done something similar? Probably a lot of these people are trying to duck their heads and stay quiet, stay away from the topic, because it's getting pretty awkward for a lot of these people.
Yeah, I was telling you last week that I saw a couple of podcasts where they were interviewing some fairly prominent Hollywood individuals, and they'd ask the question, well, did you know anything about this? And boy, talk about squirming. Like, they really, I'm not big into the whole body language thing, but it appeared that they were pretty nervous by just the way they were, and they were kind of stammering. And well, and then the really great question that was asked was, because a lot of these actors are in some really, well, let's call it what it is, pretty pornographic material. I know it's not, it wouldn't be technically called that probably, but that's kind of what it is on some of these networks. And so they were asked, well, how is it on the set where you're engaging in these types of activities that are depicting sexual harassment or assault and different things, and you're working with these women, but then, but you're not really doing it. How does that work? And it was interesting to watch them try to spin it and say, well, that's just for the show and the art, and that's not real, and we have the highest respect for each other. But then, they were trying to spin it, but I think they're kind of caught, because they are depicting the acts that they're trying to at the same time condemn. And so how do you justify that?
Yeah, I've seen some clips like that too on certain shows, and there was one they were interviewing some homosexual actor, and they were joking about, hitting on other guys at on the movie set and things like that. And then the host asked, well, you've never sexually harassed anyone, have you? And then there was a long pause, and then the actor just started laughing. But I mean, it just seems like it's almost understood that in this environment, people are going to make advances on each other, and maybe they'll get told no. Maybe they won't accept no for an answer, and it might go from there. People just, a lot of these Hollywood stars especially, seem like they have accepted that as their environment.
Yeah, you can't, the human mind doesn't work to where we can, quote unquote, pretend something all the time and then just be different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't walk around all day pretending to be in a bad mood, but I'm really a happy guy. We're one or the other. We are what we think. And if the people are thinking this way and they're acting this way and they're participating in these events, there's no way they can detach themselves from what they're doing.
Well, yeah, a prime example would be Heath Ledger, who played the Joker in one of those Batman movies. And he spent so long getting himself in the character of this satanic villain that eventually it ended up killing him. I think he had a drug overdose or some other issue that killed him prematurely. And it's pretty obvious when you turn your mind to some sort of extreme character role. I mean, there is a lot of perversion that could get in there that could really destroy lives.
It's the hypocrisy is being exposed across the board. Hollywood, the media, it's a bad deal.
Mm-hmm.
But as it was brought out on the Trumpet Daily today, when Vice President Mike Pence was mocked for not being, you know, that he would not be alone with a woman other than his wife, he was very careful about that. There were some clips that were played on the show where people were just mocking him, the comedians, and then people coming out very seriously and saying, well, he's repressing women. If he won't have private meetings with them and closed-door meetings, how could he do this? And now he looks like he's pretty smart because now, you know, who knows? You never know what people have done or not done. But, you know, it seems like he's living a lifestyle where he's just being above board and being very careful. And they even said, somebody said in one of those clips, like, oh, what, he can't control himself or something? Well, he's just being smart. You don't put yourself in terrible situations and then hope that somehow you won't get involved in whatever the situation is. I mean, do you want to send, you know, or do you want to send your kid to hang out with a bunch of drug addicts and be like, well, it's fine to hang out there, just don't get involved? Of course not. You say get away from it, right? Same with this type of thing. Just goes to show that when people follow God's laws, I mean, to whatever degree they understand them, if they follow them, it pays off in the end, even if people laugh at you when you do it.
Yeah, it is appalling just the amount of scorn that Mr. Pence faced. They tried to paint him as a sex addict or even possibly as maybe a sexual predator who was trying to contain those perverted urges. And yet, look at it from his perspective, when today it's almost like women are encouraged and even men as well to make sexual advances to try to further your career. I mean, that is encouraged. I mean, even if you just look at what they call business attire for women now, I mean, it's not much more than lingerie. Why is it that a woman would have to go into the workplace wearing something like that unless there was an ulterior motive? So you do have to be smart as a man or as a woman as well. Like we've said, the woman being physically weaker should not be putting herself in a situation like that either. I mean, it just appears like everyone's being purposefully naive about the fact that men and women are both sexually attracted to each other, and if they're by themselves, bad things could happen. You have to consider all the possibilities and make sure that you protect yourself from situations like that.
I've in most every job I had before working here, it went on at the office.
Yeah,
I mean, we all knew it. It was common knowledge. Like, oh yeah, that's what's going on.
And couldn't everyone else say that they've seen those same types of scenarios playing out, and yet we all act like, oh, there's never a cause or of any of these things. It's just that all men are sexual predators. Yeah. Let's put it into our real life practical experiences and try to deny that, well, maybe there are some of these things that are happening.
Yep. I've seen it happen myself in different workplaces, and it's it gets awkward quick.
Yeah.
But it does happen. And sometimes, and just from what I have seen in my personal working in different offices, I have seen some people rise in position because of those types of things.
Exactly.
It's happened. So people say what they want, but I'm sure many people have seen that in an office environment. It does occur. And so, yeah, it is. That's the thing. It's easy to look at, say, the big stars or the people that are in front of the camera, But if you, what, you want to go look at every company in America? Or do you want to look at every situation? Because, boy, you could start fine. And maybe in some cases it's quote-unquote consensual, whatever. That, but that doesn't make it right. But those things are going on many, many places.
Yeah, and again, we've talked about it before, too. Where are we drawing the line? It's at non-consensual intercourse. It's not at the fact that these people are fornicating, committing adultery, breaking one of God's commandments. And just for some reason, because both parties agreed to it, that's all fine. But once you get to the part where both parties aren't fine with it, that's the only thing we should even be condemning.
And that's where people are going to find themselves in really hot water is they, you know, maybe the reality was it was sort of okay at the time in their minds, in the mind of the other person. And then all of a sudden somebody changes their tune.
Yeah.
Then what are you going to say? How are you going to say, no, you know, we're going to, I mean, it's just a disaster waiting to happen. So anyway, that's more going on there. And it's talked about on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show today. Today is the 21st of November. Interesting thing that happened on this day is 1620. The Mayflower reached Provincetown, Massachusetts. The ship discharged the Pilgrims, as they became known, at Plymouth on December 26, 1620. So it was a long journey for them. On that ship, the Mayflower, they left with the Speedwell, which was leaking, and they had to go back, and it delayed them, and so they had to cross the Atlantic because of the delay at the height of the storm season. As a result, the journey was horribly unpleasant. Many of the passengers were so seasick that they could scarcely get up, and the waves were so rough that one individual was swept overboard and drowned.
No.
But one of the men on the ship said it was the just hand of God upon him because, he wrote, he was a proud and very profane young man. So they didn't have a lot of sympathy there on the Mayflower. Poor guy got swept overboard. And they said, well, so he had it coming.
I guess that is, he was kind of living contrary to their entire purpose for going over to the, to America.
Yeah.
Religious, not just religious liberty, but religious purity. That was a big part of why they came over. I saw a Prager University video that was just explaining some of the background of that because of the way that Thanksgiving is scorned now as oppressing Native Americans. But it did get into the actual history. A lot of those pilgrims came from the Netherlands, which was actually the most liberal and tolerant society in Europe. But at the same time, it was quite decadent. And so these pilgrims wanted to get their children away from those temptations. They went across the ocean. And even with that storm, they were blown off course, and they ended up landing somewhere pretty far away from where they intended.
Yeah, they spent the first winter, which only 53 passengers and half of the crew survived, living on board the Mayflower. And once they moved ashore, then they faced even more challenges. Of course, they didn't come over to a modern America. They didn't go to Walmart. They had to figure out how to live. And so that was a tough situation for them. But as you said, they wanted to get away from the Church of England. They felt like they weren't, the Church of England wasn't removed enough from the Catholic Church. And they wanted religious purity in a lot of cases as they sought. And actually, they referred to themselves as saints. Mm-hmm. Only now do we call them pilgrims, but they called themselves saints when they came over.
Yeah, that definitely shows you they had a high moral compass. At least they really tried hard to live the right way. I guess they are pretty much roundly scorned today as well. Anyone who tries to live in any way similar to them would be ridiculed in today's society because we have just totally slid morally.
Yeah, we don't. Well, just even the story before that about just all the things you see happening in this country. Yeah. You know, they were coming here. You know, they came here. They wanted to establish a nation that they felt like would be based on God's law. Mm-hmm. And then if they could come to life today and see what's become of it, just looking at the headlines, they would be, I'm sure, they would be ashamed and embarrassed to even read the news stories about what's going on.
Yeah, we are living quite contrary to the way that the pilgrims, the founders of the nation, intended for us to. It's also interesting because that Prager University video also mentioned how the Thanksgiving ties in some way to the Feast of Tabernacles, which I need to look into more, but that is actually one of the commanded annual festivals in the Bible that very few people today actually observe, even though Thanksgiving points to it.
That's very interesting. I've not seen that before, but I'd be interested in
it. Yeah, I'll do some more research, and maybe we can talk about it later.
Yeah, that'd be very interesting. We want to conclude today's program by going into this booklet a little more, God as a Family. Thought it was just a good time to go into it because there's such an attack on family and the anything to do with the biblical model of family in this country is just under attack. I had a recent Time magazine talking all about these different gender categories. Well, it's a third gender. Now we need another gender because some people don't feel this way and that way. It's like it's just getting more and more confusing and more away from any sort of truth on the matter. And so the further away you get from a biblical truth, it's just chaos. And so this is a great booklet. God is a Family that talks about that very fact, that God is a family. He's not a trinity, as some people would see it. He exists. It is a family that man can be part of. And as it points out early in the booklet, and we talked about yesterday, God wants us to prove these things. So we're going to spend some time, the rest of the show today, a few minutes, looking at a few things that begin to prove this, that God is a family. And one of the passages that is brought out right away is John 1, which is, even though it's, you know, not till about the middle of the Bible as we see it, it actually is the earliest. Trivia question for you. See, early in terms of relating to talking about a period of time. And it talks about before the angels were created and before the universe of man or man was created, God and the Word existed, these two beings, two personages. And they're revealed in this earliest account in the Bible. There is no mention of the Holy Spirit. So when people are thinking about the Trinity, they consider the Holy Spirit to be this other person, this three-person Godhead. Well, they mention nothing about it here in John 1, verses 1 through 4. They just mention God and the Word. In the beginning, that's what there was.
And it is incredible. Think about that, because literally there is nothing else. I try to imagine what it would be like if there was nothing but blackness all around me at all times. There is nothing physical around me. I was just kind of floating in the air. And that's basically what they were dealing with. And that passage there is even proof that the Holy Spirit is the power of God and the Word. It's not a third being. It's not their friend who's sitting next to them.
Right.
It's actually within them. And that's why the Trinity is so false, because they try to personify the Holy Spirit.
And people get confused because sometimes the Holy Spirit is referred to as He, which is really just a mistranslation. It's a power. It's not a masculine or feminine being. It's not a being at all. It's just the power. Mr. Armstrong explains that very well in quite a few of his books, including Mystery of the Ages.
But a lot of other languages, too, they will use he or she, like masculine or feminine pronouns for certain words. I mean, you know, for a vase or for a burrito, you would use he or she pronouns, but it doesn't mean that those physical objects are alive somehow.
Right. That's a really good point. So obviously you're looking at the Bible being translated into English, and so you've got some differences there that you have to look into. But the word in John 1 is translated from the Greek word logos, which means spokesman. And in verse 14 of John 1 there, it says, and the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. So, of course, that was Jesus Christ. And Mr. Armstrong wrote Mystery of the Ages this. He said, the Word, then, is a personage who was made flesh, begotten by God, who through this later begettal became His Father. And see, we can understand these things because we understand physical family and how the birth process works, which is why God made it that way, so we can understand these spiritual concepts. You get away from the physical concept of the family, the way the Bible lays it out, you're going to be lost trying to figure out the spiritual concept. And so you can see why there's such an attack against it today by Satan, whichever way it is, whether it's through false religion or just the diluting of what is a family and what does that mean. When you lose the physical model based on the Bible, you cannot understand the way God operates and the way His family operates.
The trend is definitely toward confusion, whether we're talking about on the physical level with the family or on the spiritual level, where so much of religion, like we say, does point to the Trinity as the Godhead, the closed-off Godhead that never has the potential to expand beyond those three members. But that booklet does even bring out, that God is a Family booklet also brings out just how absurd it would be if God and the Word and the Holy Spirit were three in one and one in three, because there are certain passages that list all three of them, and yet if they're all the same, then it just becomes a huge jumbled mess. You cannot tell what is happening in those verses anymore. Again, it obscures the meaning of the Bible. It just causes more confusion. It prevents people who are trying to be Christians from understanding what God is trying to tell them. It's all trending toward confusion, and you see the same thing with physical family being flipped on its head. Any given day, a male can decide he's a female or vice versa. Those types of things just obscure the deep vision in all of this.
Right, and if people are thinking that God is some sort of a three in one, one in three, it's obviously confusing, which they admit, like, well, no one can understand this. But it creates so many logical issues. You know, for example, when Christ was crucified, who resurrected him? You know, a separate being, his father. You know, but so anyway, there's just some logical gaps that
well, right, because he was literally dead and in the ground for 3 days and three nights. He was dead. He wasn't able to resurrect himself. There had to have been a separate being. And if they were all the same, that just it is beyond comprehension. That is why they tell you can't understand it. And that's also why certain religions don't really want you to read the Bible. They just want you to believe whatever the physical representatives of the church say.
Yeah, you see that same sort of thinking, whether it be false religion or false science or false anything, is it gets to a point where logically you say, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. And they say, well, we just can't understand it. It's beyond our understanding. And that's why people a lot of times become dissatisfied with religion, or maybe not so much with science, but if they're thinking they should be, like, well, that doesn't make sense to me, though. You know, how does evolution make sense? Well, you just can't understand it.
You're not a scientist. You can't figure this out. Yeah. You're not a priest. Yeah. You don't have my level of expertise. So, in fact, you shouldn't even look into it. You shouldn't try to study it or prove it for yourself or learn how to think independently. Just rely on these authorities who say things dogmatically. Just whatever they say, believe it.
It's funny that people, in a lot of cases, accept that, because you know how people buck against the system, no matter what it is. If somebody says you can't, most people say, oh, yeah, I'll show you. But if somebody says, well, you can't understand it, you're not a scientist, or well, you can't understand it, you're not a theologian, many people are like, well, I'm probably right. You know, you think just naturally and say, wait a second, yeah, you can't tell me that. I'm going to look into this for myself.
Yeah, it's almost like we yawn and turn back to our phones, and then we don't really bother to look into it too deeply. And yet, apparently, if these guys are able to study into it deeply, we all have human minds. We all have the capability of proving these things for ourselves. But what they're trying to say is that it's impossible for us to ever get to that point of understanding it.
Right. And then of course, you're just relying on somebody's word. You have to take their word for it.
And people lie. Did you know people lie a lot?
I've noticed that. There's some really interesting passages that are brought out here in Genesis 1. In the beginning, or a beginning, it should read, God created the heaven and the earth. And Mr. Armstrong wrote about this, and he says this originally was written by Moses as God inspired him, and Moses wrote in Hebrew. And the Hebrew word translated God as Elohim. It's a noun or name. It's plural in form, but normally singular in grammatical usage. It is the same sort of word as family, church, or group. We understand that, right? The family consisting of two or more members, one church composed of many members, or one group of several persons. It is referring precisely to the same persons making up or composing the one God, as we found in John 1:1. So when people say God, they tend to think of God the Father, I suppose, or maybe they're referring to Christ in some way, but they tend to think of a singular being. But really, unless you're specifically saying which one, God is really saying the family of God. It's just like saying, you know, I go to that church. People understand it's one church, but there's multiple people in it. Mm-hmm. That's an easy concept for us to understand, I think. And it's the same way here when referring to God.
Right. And we could also think of God as like a last name, a family last name. And so if you do get more specific, you know, in your Falk family, there's a father, a mother, and two children, and yet you're all Falks. You're different people, but you're all under that same family name. And that's how Mr. Armstrong described it as well. It makes a lot more sense when you think of it that way. It's a whole lot easier to understand God being like a last name of a family.
Yeah. And in verse 26 of Genesis 1, very famous passage, I think, it says, "And God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness." And it's easy to just kind of read over that, but if you think about it, well, who's he talking to? He said, us, let's us do it. And the God who became the Father was talking to the Word. Let's make man. We'll make them in our image. We'll make them after our likeness. We want them to look like us, and we want them to take on our character. And that's what's being said there. And so you can see that, you know, why would God make the animals look like the animals? But he says, I want man to look like me.
Mm-hmm.
It's because we have that same potential, not just in terms of our physical appearance, but in our character development.
Right. And another interesting aspect of this is just how the name Elohim, it is like a group noun. It is talking about a group of people, but that definition never sets a specific cap of three members like the Trinity does. If you're going to be using a word like Elohim for God in the Bible, it would have to be a more specific definition so that you would prevent the confusion of people thinking that, oh, well, it seems like the family could just keep on expanding. With that type of a word, it doesn't. There's no way you could limit God to three separate beings like what the Trinity does.
Yeah, there's a great passage in lots of great passages in this booklet, but Hebrews 2, where it says, you know, what is man that you are mindful of him, talking about, well, why is he concerned with human beings, or the Son of Man that you visit him? And it says, you made him a little lower than the angels, and it should read for a little while lower, and you crowned him with glory and honor, did set him over the works of your hands. You have put all things in subjection under his feet, for in that he put all in subjection under him. He left nothing that is not put under him, but now we see not yet all things put under him. There's a lot more that man can do once he's in God's family. There's a greater, much greater potential, and of course, then you're not man, you're God anymore. But, I mean, you have to look at that and take it for what it says. They put all things in subjection under his feet. All things? Like the universe? How's that? How could you do that? We can't even barely get to the moon.
Yeah.
So you have to look at what these passages say, and they're not just like sort of a, you know, a feel-good metaphor or something. It's talking about the future of mankind.
That's right, and there are passages in the Bible where God challenges us to become perfect as he is, to even become God as God is God. And yet, still, a lot of Christian denominations say that there are angels, there is the Trinity, the Godhead, and there is also those who have ascended to heaven. But they're not angels, and they're not gods. They're just people who have ascended, and they're nothing else. Even though God is telling us to become exactly like him, people consider it blasphemy to then go that, oh, well, these people who have ascended are now God beings. They think that connection can't be made, even though in their teachings, the people up in heaven are spirit beings anyway.
Yeah, it's very confusing, but it doesn't have to be. And this booklet really brings out a lot of great information about God as a family. We'll talk about that more throughout the week, and you can get it at thetrumpet.com right now. But those are some just interesting thoughts to end on today, and really hopeful ones too. That's all the time we have for today's edition of Trumpet Radio Live. Make sure you listen for the Key of David program and the Trumpet Daily Radio Show coming up in a bit. Thanks for spending some time with me, Dwight Falk, and Grant Turgeon today. Have a great rest of your day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.